From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And with just 2 days to go until the French presidential election, voters there are glued to news of yesterday's shooting in Paris that killed a police officer. ISIS has claimed responsibility. The gunman was also killed. Joining us now is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. And Eleanor, first, what more do we know about the shooting?
Well, we know that the perpetrator is a 39-year-old French citizen who grew up outside of Paris. That's been confirmed by authorities. They are still conducting house and apartment raids of family and friends of his. They found, according to French media, many automatic rifles in his car, a Koran, and some material related to radicalization. He was known to police. He had a murder conviction. He served time in jail in 2005, but he was not at all known as a suspected radical, Islamist radical. He was not being watched for that. He was being watched for just being a violent person.
Now, President Trump today tweeted that this will have a big effect on the presidential election in France. How are people reacting in Paris?
Well, it could have an effect. First of all, on the streets of Paris, things are as usual. I took my son to school this morning. People refuse to have their lives changed by, you know, random acts of lone gunmen. But it is horrible. Now, we are hearing different things from the presidential candidates. Three of the top candidates called off their campaigning today. It's the last day of the campaign before the first round on Sunday, where 11 candidates will be whittled down to two. Now, two of the front runners are conservative. One is François Fillon. He's a mainstream conservative. The other is Marine Le Pen from the far right. They seem to be, I don't want to say capitalizing, but yes, talking about this incident a lot, maybe to get last-minute votes. Fillon says he's been warning the government for years that there is a growing totalitarian Islam out there, and he said he'll make fighting ISIS his top priority. Marine Le Pen says the French government has done everything possible to make terrorism worse, and she was criticized. She spoke this week, actually, and before the shooting, and she said, if I had been in power, we would not have had the terrorist attacks of 2015 and 16, because she says anyone with a double nationality who is suspected of any terrorist activity, she will expel them from France. So the attackers were all French citizens, but they had North African dual citizenship. Hmm. She says they wouldn't even have even been in the country, and she doesn't even want to give people dual citizenship from immigrant backgrounds if they have any kind of police record. So she's really taking a hard line.
Now, you've mentioned two of the candidates in the race for president. There are 11 altogether at this point, but four who, it appears, could end up moving on in some way. But tell us about the other two, the ones
right
on the left.
Okay, well, the other two, one is far-left leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon. His policies, social and economic policies, are actually very similar to the far right of Marine Le Pen. He wants, you know, big social spending. He wants to protect workers and industry. He wants to get out of Europe, although in the last few days he's denying that, but he doesn't like Europe. The other candidate is Emmanuel Macron. He's 39 years old. He was Hollande's economy minister for 2 years, and he's a former investment banker. He actually left the ministry to form his own political movement, and he's running on that. He says he's not left or right. He has a new progressive vision for France, and he's got a big following. He's currently in first place, but just by a point in front of Marine Le Pen. Analysts are saying that he's actually very fragile, and people who, a lot of Fillon is the only mainstream candidate who's actually been in government and served. He was prime minister under President Sarkozy. Analysts are saying that people may be scared to trust someone young and untested like Macron after an attack like this. So this is making the election even more unsure. Nobody can predict who the two winners on Sunday will be.
Now, Macron had a conversation yesterday with President Obama, and he tweeted a video clip of their conversation. They were talking on a speakerphone. Let's listen to a little bit.
The main message I have is to wish you all the best in the coming days, and make sure that, as you said, you work hard all the way through, because you never know. It might be that last day of campaigning that.
Yeah, I do agree.
Makes all the difference.
Now, at the end of the video clip, Obama says, good luck, which I guess is not exactly an endorsement, but it sounds a little like one.
Yeah.
Does it help Macron to have Obama?
It does. It really does. That seems like an endorsement to me. Obama is still very popular in France. And Macron has even been called the French Obama because he's somebody totally new, you know, so this is an endorsement for him, and this is a good thing. But, you know, with this latest attack, this is going to, people are going to look at him and go, he's innovative, he might have some new ideas, but he's 39, he's untested. Can we really go with him at such a crucial time when we're fighting ISIS and we're having attacks, you know, on an iconic boulevard in the center of Paris when you've got thousands of people strolling and at cafes? I mean, it's just, it's a very tense time.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joining us from Paris. Eleanor, thank you.
You're welcome.
And in this country, scientists and their supporters will march in protest tomorrow in hundreds of cities across the nation. Many are concerned about the future of science under President Trump, who has appointed climate change skeptics to key positions in his administration and proposed cuts to basic research in his budget. But not all scientists think the march is a good idea. David Hyde from here, now contributor KUOW, reports from Seattle.
Nicole Baker is a research scientist at the University of Washington. She studies the state of global fish stocks.
So their B over BMSY or F over MSY are closer to one. Those are healthy stocks. So we're going to look at if stocks that are considered healthy.
Baker's 30 years old. She says she's never been an activist or participated in a political march before.
I did not have any level of political engagement when I was in college. I studied and had fun and traveled, and politics was not even on my radar.
But last year, when Donald Trump ran for president, Baker got political.
I think the nomination of Scott Pruitt as the EPA chief who doesn't believe in climate change just totally put me over the edge.
Baker says she's alarmed that President Trump and some members of his cabinet seem to dismiss basic science, like the role carbon dioxide plays in controlling the Earth's climate, and that the president slashed science research funding in his proposed budget. But Baker says she doesn't see the March for Science as a partisan issue.
If there was a Democratic president who was doing the same things, I would feel the same way about marching.
Robert Young agrees with Baker that science is under attack, but he says marching is the wrong tactic.
It's going to reinforce the messages that they've been getting from the conservative media all along. That the scientists are really just liberal environmentalists, or the scientists have their own political agenda.
Robert Young is a coastal geologist at Western Carolina University, and he spent more than a decade studying the Elwha Dam removal project here in Washington State. And he says the science march reveals a larger problem with how scientists sometimes talk about their work to the general public, that they're not always thinking hard enough about how their messages will be received by people who don't know any scientists or people who live in places where Donald Trump won.
You know, I can't go to talk to my in-laws about climate change and start the conversation with polar bears. My in-laws live in eastern North Carolina. What they care about is having a job. And, you know, what the soybean crop is this year. They don't care about polar bears. And you may think that that's terrible, but that's the way that the world works.
Alan Berzo has a PhD in microbiology from the University of Washington. He says the left shares in responsibility for any decline in respect for science.
For every sin that you can point to conservatives, such as denying climate change or denying evolution, you can also point to the progressive left and say, look, there are environmental organizations that deny the benefits of GMOs. There are left-wing organizations that deny the safety of nuclear power.
Berzo is currently a senior fellow at the American Council on Science and Health, which describes itself as anti-environmental activist on issues like nuclear power.
I don't buy this idea that the war on science comes from the right. I don't really buy it that it comes from the left. I buy that politicians are politicians, and they will throw science under the bus whenever they think it suits them.
Sarah Myrie is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Washington. She has this perspective on the march.
To say that science is not political and to say that we're going to have problems down the line if we politicize science, it's like saying, you know, science is about empiricism, which is this pure thing up above our heads that doesn't have anything to do with politics. And frankly, that's wrong.
And for Myrie, it's not just a march for science. It's also a march against how science is currently organized. She says it excludes women and minorities.
We are marching to defend an inclusive and diverse culture inside of science, a culture that accepts women as a part of the scientific community, a culture that accepts people of color and people that have been disenfranchised inside of science. And so there are incredibly important social and cultural issues that interface with the scientific community right now, and those are also a part of the March for Science.
So not every scientist is going to be marching for the same reason, and not every scientist is going to march. But everyone I spoke with had one thing in common, a shared belief that something important about the identity of the country is at stake if people don't stand up for science right now.
Think about the things that American science has done in the last 100 years. We put people on the moon. We landed an instrument on an asteroid. We have a robot driving around Mars right now. We are a driving force across the entire planet for health and safety and reducing costs and reducing risk.
For Here and Now, I'm David Hyde in Seattle.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions angered many in Hawaii yesterday. He was speaking to conservative radio host Mark Levin when he criticized a ruling from a Hawaii federal judge that blocked President Trump's revised travel ban last month.
I really am amazed that a judge sitting on an island in the Pacific can issue an order that stops the President of the United States from what appears to be clearly his statutory and constitutional powers.
Well, that reference to Hawaii, an American state, as, quote, an island in the Pacific, is not going over very well at all on social media. And joining us to take a look at that and other stories this week is Danielle Belton, managing editor at The Root. Hi there, Danielle.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay. Well, I guess okay. I mean, but give us the reaction to what the attorney general said. How are Hawaiians reacting?
Some would say that it caused an eruption of sorts all over Twitter. People were hot, like that hot magma lava, over this. We had one user on Twitter, Brooklyn Dad Defiant, who wrote, "Somebody please remind ignorant Jeff Sessions where Pearl Harbor took place."
Yeah.
You know, others were like, wait, so did the birthers just not realize Hawaii was a state? And user Mimi LaRoche tweeted, "Can we send Jeff Sessions on a 3-hour tour of an island in the Pacific?"
Well, the attorney general himself, I made a mistake there. The attorney general in Hawaii, the Hawaiian attorney general, has also taken to Twitter. What has he said?
He basically has come out against what Jeff Sessions has said.
Yeah, there's just this, this continued negative reaction here. I mean, it's hard to fully understand why the U.S. Attorney General would have said what he said, but apparently he's standing by it. Well, let's move on to the other big news of the week, and that is Bill O'Reilly's firing from Fox News. Of course, advertisers had been fleeing the show after the New York Times reported millions of dollars in payouts to settle various sexual harassment claims. And O'Reilly continues to deny the allegations. But there are reports that he's going to get a $25 million payout when he leaves Fox. So what is the reaction to that online?
I mean, it depends on like which side of Twitter you're looking at. For a certain segment of Twitter, it was a nonstop party. People Photoshop wigs on O'Reilly, making references to his dig at Representative Maxine Waters. People post old memes of O'Reilly, including his legendary jousting match with rapper Cam'ron, who taunted O'Reilly with "you mad." You know, and, you know, a lot of people pointed out that it took at least 5 women speaking up, $13 million settlement money over the years, and a New York Times investigation to out Bill O'Reilly, that it wasn't his past statements or his past actions, that it took like this basically this avalanche of news to kind of take him out. But things were a little bit different on, you know, with more conservative Twitter users. It was a little quieter on that end. Mm-hmm. But some did have some things to say. I mean, basically, they accused the liberal media of conducting a conservative media purge. People said there was a liberal double standard, bringing up yet again Bill Clinton and his accusers in comparison to Bill O'Reilly. And others, though, chose to focus on celebrating his replacement, Tucker Carlson, tweeting, "It's Tucker time."
Huh, interesting. Well, in the minute and a half that we have left here, I want to talk with you about another story of the week. That's about Steve Stevens. He posted a video on Facebook where he allegedly killed an elderly man. That man was Robert Godwin Sr. in Cleveland. And police say that Stevens killed himself after a police chase earlier this week. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg did comment on the fact that the video was posted to Facebook at the company's developer conference this week. Let's listen.
"Our hearts go out to the family and friends of Robert Godwin Sr. And we have a lot of work, and we will keep doing all we can to prevent tragedies like this from happening."
Danielle, what's your reaction to that?
You know, it's interesting that, you know, Facebook took so long to catch this. I mean, the reality is, you know, the video was up for almost 2 hours. The second video where he actually is shown allegedly killing the man was up for nearly 2 hours before Facebook took the video down, claiming they didn't receive any reports until very late in the video being up. The third video, like, played to its completion before they heard a report and Facebook was able to act on it and take it down. It really shows the vulnerability here.
Yeah.
Of these particular mediums where, you know, anybody can hop on Facebook Live and put up a video at any given time. And unless the users flag it,
right.
You know, there's with so many people on Facebook, there's really no way to catch it.
Well, Danielle Belton is managing editor at The Root. Danielle, thanks as always.
Thank you.
A new comedy series is streaming on Netflix today. It's called Girl Boss. The show is inspired by the memoir of the same name by American businesswoman Sophia Amoruso. Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic, and he's with us to talk about the show. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
Okay, so maybe some folks don't know who Sophia Amoruso is now, but after watching the show, do you think she'll be a household name?
Well, I don't know about that. Okay. The show is loosely based on her life, so I don't know if people will necessarily make the connection. And the real life of Sophia has had some setbacks. She gained notoriety. She wrote a best-selling memoir that provides the title of the show. But her Nasty Gal online fashion franchise filed for bankruptcy at the end of last year. And she's been trying to sort of rebuild her image since that happened. Actually, this show might be the best thing to happen to her in a while. But they don't make a lot of effort, I think, to connect her character to the real-life person. So it'll be interesting to see if this actually raises her profile more or if people sort of see this as a separate thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you said, the show loosely follows Amoruso's life. She's a scrappy young millennial who comes up with a great business idea for this fashion startup called, as you said, Nasty Gal, and makes it big, right?
Yeah, what we see in the first season that's been presented to us, we see her decide to start an eBay online store where she resells thrift store items. It's almost like her superhero origin story. It's sort of like she can walk into a thrift store and see the clothing there that can actually be sold for a lot more money than the store realizes it's worth. But they try to take this rather conventional origin story and add a lot of creativity, and the character, I think, is what people will either respond to or will find very controversial.
Ah, okay. So let's listen to a little bit of tape here. It's a moment where Sophia's sitting on a park bench, and she's complaining to another person sitting next to her.
Adulthood is where dreams go to die. Grow up, get a job, become a drone, that's it. Then it's over. Society just wants to put everyone in a box. Well, guess what, society? There is no box.
So is this millennial truth or millennial narcissism? What is it?
It is definitely millennial narcissism. And I think this show really pushes that envelope. And they're lucky in that they got an actress, Britt Robertson. People may remember her as the female lead in the George Clooney film Tomorrowland. She played the young girl that was his co-star, and she was also in the CBS series Under the Dome. And she's always been a charismatic, capable actress who's kind of been on the verge.
Yeah.
And she's been looking for a great project to kind of boost her career, and this might be it. At least she's able to, you know, sand off the edges of Sophia a little bit and make us care a little bit about this character, but she is so self-involved and so dysfunctional that sometimes I think it's very hard to sort of dial into her, what she's going through, and really identify with her.
You know, you're actually being quite gentle in comparison to some other reviews I've seen. There's one out of The Guardian where The Guardian writes, "Girl Boss is so unrelentingly tone-deaf to the human condition, it's hard to know where to start. It's a show which fully mistakes being an overindulged horror show for being an assertive millennial role model."
Yeah, well, you know, that's the Brits have a way of putting a point on things, don't they? I always try to take a breath because people said that kind of thing about girls as well. And what you realize with girls, at least, is that they were trying to subvert and explore and even make fun of that trait in millennials as much as they were embodying it. I don't think Girl Boss pulls that off, and that's part of the problem with the show. I think if they would narrow their creative vision a little more and figure out a more compelling arc for Sophia's character, the show could really be great. And, you know, seeing that Girls just wrapped up its run, I think there's a little bit of an opening in television for an insightful series about a millennial woman who's finding her voice. I'm just not sure this one is it.
My last thought is in complete agreement with that. Like, I welcome authentic stories about the experience that millennials are having. And to that end, you know, maybe the show that they need to make is what Sophia's doing now because she's got to rebuild. She's got to rebuild her image, her life, and her business. Like, that's a great story.
Right. Well, and again, you know, sort of this idea that you have to tell these stories about millennials who are on the cusp of poverty, or they've got 10 roommates, or that's another thing that makes it feel a little cliched. You know, it might be cool to see somebody who is privileged and faces a setback and has to regroup. That might be a really interesting story. Unfortunately, that's not the story that they're telling right now. So maybe we should go off and write that story together. You ready to get out of the journalism biz?
I'll meet you in the writer's room.
Sounds good.
Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. Eric, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
And next week is a milestone, 100 days for the Trump administration. Tamara Keith looks at the historical significance of those first 100 days this afternoon on All Things Considered. You're listening to Here and Now.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
For the first time, Verizon is losing more customers than it's adding. Around 300,000 cell phone subscribers left Verizon since the start of this year, according to an earnings report released yesterday. And those customers are defecting to Verizon's competitors, T-Mobile and Sprint. Joining us with more is Lynette Lopez, senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. Lynette, welcome back. And what's going on?
Well, I think what's really interesting that we're seeing here is that cell phone customers are becoming more like airline customers, which is to say they're price sensitive above everything. You know, what Verizon didn't do was give people an unlimited data plan, and people are using more and more data. The competition did, but, you know, they weren't as, let's say the connections weren't as good as Verizon. Hmm. You know, the whole Can You Hear Me Now ad campaign was big for Verizon because they said we have the most spectrum, the best connections. But meanwhile, the other carriers were competing on price and at the same time spending billions of dollars buying spectrum in Utah and the Southeast, like T-Mobile just did. So improving their connections and at the same time taking share by appealing to the price sensitivity of American consumers.
So the networks in general are all getting a little bit better. It's harder to say, well, can you hear me now? You can only do that on Verizon. But also in February, Verizon reintroduced those unlimited data plans. Did that help?
Not really, because Verizon's plan was still more expensive than the other plans. Mm. This is just the consumer saying, yeah, I'd rather talk on a shakier connection than, you know, pay the extra $40 every month. And in general, wireless prices are falling because of this. They fell 11.4% in March from a year before. So we're definitely seeing this impact the industry as a whole.
So consumers are in a way benefiting from this because the prices are going down. What about Verizon in particular? It is in the process of buying Yahoo. It recently bought AOL. Is part of the company's strategy to move away from cell phone service?
Well, I think that every media organization or telecommunication organization is looking for ways to diversify what they're doing. I think the idea in media right now is that content, connection, and device are all going to seamlessly become one thing as we go into the future. So you're seeing these mergers, you're seeing these companies try to become bigger in the face of uncertainty in the market. And Verizon's plan, you know, to hook up with Yahoo, if you're talking about, you know, Yahoo and AOL, those aren't the two hottest brands in the world. Right, Verizon's right. Still, you know, trying to keep its options open. Twitter kind of started like ridiculing the name of the merged entity, which is called Oath. So Recently, Verizon's CEO started talking about, hey, you know, I'd be interested in, you know, Disney or maybe NBC Universal or Comcast. So what these companies are trying to do is just get as big as strong as possible before they have to go into the next phase, whether it's 5G or creating content themselves, starting their own networks, whatever it is. It's really uncertain, but everyone knows they want to be strong in the face of it.
That's Lynette Lopez, senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. Lynette, thanks so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has just returned from a coast-to-coast culinary road trip. Kathy has stories to tell, and she joins us now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
So, first of all, before we get to the food, just tell me the route that you took, because it's very similar to a route that I took across the country, the southern route.
We did the southern route. We left San Francisco in the end of March, and we went to L.A. We went down and around. Austin, Texas was in the middle, and then up the East Coast.
It's such a great drive.
Gorgeous.
But it is made even better by the food that you get to along the way. So let's start with what you found in Los Angeles.
I just realized why we get along so well, because that was at the heart of the whole trip. So we started in L.A., and we went to many great places, and I'll tell you all about them on the webpage. But among the most memorable was Korean barbecue. According to L.A. food critic Jonathan Gold, L.A. has more Koreans than any place outside of Korea. And we landed at Park's Barbecue, where I know you've been as well.
Yeah.
It's very sleek and black and cool. And in the middle of your table is a grill, which is powered by gas and charcoal briquettes. And the thing about Park's Barbecue is that they have very high-quality meat.
Yeah.
Kobe-style prime beef, brisket, pork belly, short ribs. And the waiter adds them to the hot fire, and you cook them. And then you have dozens of dipping sauces and side dishes. And, boy, I just loved it.
So Park's Barbecue, get your KBBQ on in L.A. What was the next stop?
Next stop was Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is just a gorgeous town with adobe houses. And we arrived late at night and landed at a wonderful place called Cafe Pascual's. But it was the next day at lunch when we asked a bunch of locals, where do you guys eat? What's the best place to go for lunch? And everybody said, oh, La Choza. You got to go to La Choza. Mm. They are famous for their red and green chilies and their outdoor patio. It's in an old adobe building. So John, my husband, had a green chili stew with local green chilies, incredibly tender pork and potatoes. I went for the enchilada plate, which was gigantic.
And I hope had green chilies in it.
I had a green chili sauce on it. It was served with pinto beans and pozole, and maybe best of all was the hot, puffy sopapillas, the delicate fried bread, and you drizzle it with local honey. We just loved La Choza.
On my trip across the country in the New Mexico portion, of course, we did get some green chilies and a green chili plant, which is still alive today.
All right.
Here in the Northeast.
We should have done that. Mm. We brought back some chili peppers, but then we hit the road, and we had a long drive, and we went to Austin, Texas to visit friends, and Austin has just become a remarkable food city, most famous for barbecue, but we ate really sophisticated French food, the Japanese food and sushi, breakfast tacos. But it was when we drove out of town, about 30 minutes to Lockhart, Texas, to Smitty's Barbecue, that my dreams came true.
Mm.
It's an old meat market. It opened in 1924, and it's still a working meat market. But in 1978, they opened a barbecue restaurant. So let me just have you picture this. You walk down a long hallway, and everything is black. The ceiling, the walls, the floor, and it's all this black patina from the smoke, because everything at Smitty's is cooked over open fire. We were lucky enough to meet Nina Schmidt-Sells. She is the daughter of Smitty, And she told us a little bit about their style of cooking.
We use local post-oak wood, and it's got a lot of that wood flavor to it. It's over an open pit fire, and it's not like tenderized in a cooker. Sometimes it's a little bit more tough than what someone wants, but I just call it, it's a strong beef. It's what we do over the, you know, what a cowboy would do on an open pit.
What a cowboy would do. Now, I just need to explain to you, when she says open fires, she means this quite literally. There are these open fire pits inside the restaurant. Mm. And what they really excel at are sausages. I met Jerry Mendoza. He's been working there for 15 years, and he hand stuffs the sausages. He hand ties them, and he makes a jalapeno sausage that when you bite into it, juice just spurts out, and it is so full of flavor, and I never thought I would like a barbecued sausage like that. Smitty's was like walking back in time, an absolutely fabulous adventure.
And, you know, this is where our trips have diverged a little bit, because I went to, also outside of Austin, the Salt Lick Barbecue.
Yep, very
which
famous.
I loved and thought it was fantastic, but some of the real Texas barbecue nuts thought maybe I was going a little touristy.
You got to go to Lockhart next time. There's three barbecue places in Lockhart, but we'll move on.
All right, let's get on to New Orleans, the next stop on your trip.
We weren't supposed to go. We were so close. I'm like, you got to go to New Orleans. And anyone who's ever been there knows it's a first-class food city, and we could spend the whole show talking about that. But I just wanted to tell you quickly about a fairly new restaurant called Maypop. I am very suspicious of fusion food. I generally think it's a big failure. But Maypop fuses the flavors of southeastern Louisiana with the flavors of southeastern Asia. And it's wildly successful. So think Delta-inspired Vietnamese. Mm. There were fried local oysters with a bourbon barrel soy mash aioli and spicy cucumbers. Mm. Or there was a house-made squid ink fuselli with local blue crab, chorizo sausage, coconut butter, and mint. And it sounds like, really? Does that work? And I am here to tell you it does. There's a substantial Vietnamese population in New Orleans. And this is a very sophisticated, successful fusion.
And New Orleans, as we know, is a great food city. What about Chattanooga? Beautiful Chattanooga, that was your next stop, and you found some fried chicken.
We did, and it was an unexpected stop. There were tornado warnings, so we had to pull over, and I'm like, well, we got to eat, and fried chicken kept popping up. So I found out about a place called Bee's. It's an all-you-can-eat fried chicken and southern food time warp of a restaurant. There was the chicken and barbecued pork and potato salad and coleslaw and cornbread and everything is made from scratch. And I met Brian Bradshaw, who is the great-grandson of Bee herself, and he and his dad, Mike, still run Bee's. And he told us a story about fried chicken.
When the preacher would come for Sunday dinner after church, everybody would take turns feeding the preacher after church because there weren't any restaurants. And so local farmers would kill a chicken, and the pulley bone was actually what the preacher got. It was a large piece in the center of the breast. So we kind of played on that. We cut a pulley bone out of our breast, and we cut it into four pieces. It makes them small, so they, the fry time's not as much, and it also makes them more tender and juicy.
I got to tell you, Jeremy, it was so tender and so juicy, and when I pushed him a little harder for the secret, he clammed up. But his answer was, that's an expensive recipe.
Are you a fried chicken maker?
Yes, I do make it at home. I like to make it in a wok, but there's nothing like good fried chicken down south.
Okay, next stop, Asheville, North Carolina.
Asheville's a real foodie city also. In recent years, it's really risen. There's been a lot of buzz. We ended up at a beautiful restaurant called Night Bell, owned by a young up-and-coming chef named Katie Buttons. And she has a very creative, sophisticated take on Appalachian and classic Southern food. The most amazing thing was the deviled egg, which comes in a scooped-out eggshell and combines this ethereal corn sabayon with local trout and spicy pimento, and it was just amazing. And then a steamer clam dish from South Carolina with Tennessee Benton's bacon, smoked cream, and cider was this fascinating take on New England clam chowder. She's got something really special going there.
In Asheville, North Carolina, and we have time for one more stop from your trip, and that would be Richmond, Virginia.
Big surprise. There was a lot of good food in Richmond. We went to Pearly's Restaurant and Deli. There was a long line weaving on the outside. I had the Benny Goodman, which was two latkes, potato pancakes, topped with hand-sliced smoked salmon, poached eggs, dill hollandaise, and salmon roe. And John had the cheese blintzes, which were the lightest, most incredible things with ricotta cheese, preserved orange, and blueberry sauce, and we took a Cubano, their take on a Cubano, on the road for us, and it lasted us almost to Connecticut.
Wow. Were there any places that you went along the way that you didn't like? Did you hit any duds?
We didn't, and that's because I researched like crazy. I just was researching every bit of the way because I just wanted to find something truly regional and original and something that we don't get here in New England. It's not an East Coast. I wanted to taste the place, and I have to say it was very successful.
That's Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, who has been traveling across the country, and we will show you some photos of her adventures at our website, hereandnow.org, and obviously we'll list those restaurants in case you find yourself on the road. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
A new study suggests that people who drink a lot of diet soda may have a higher risk of both stroke and dementia. Those who drink it daily, especially, are more likely to develop one of those diseases compared to those who have diet soda far less often. For more, we're joined now by the lead author of the study, Matthew Pauze. He's a neurologist at the Boston University School of Medicine. He joins us via Skype. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first of all, tell us more about the findings of this study, a possible higher risk of stroke and dementia if you drink diet soda every day?
Sure. So it's important to note that our results are observational, which means we observe trends amongst a large group of people, but our results certainly do not suggest causality. In other words, we can't be sure that diet sodas are causing stroke or causing dementia, but we are seeing associations between those who more frequently consume diet soda and a higher risk of both stroke and dementia within the next 10 years.
And what is the elevated risk?
Sure. So those who were drinking diet soda on a daily basis, their risk for stroke and dementia was about 3 times as high as compared to someone who was not drinking diet soda.
I see. Now, again, just to reiterate, you're not saying that there's any causation here, but did your study look at any other possible variables around why this elevated risk might be there?
Sure. So now that we've shown this association, it's going to be important to understand why that association might be there to try and understand it in more detail. It's possible that diet sodas are associated with risk factors like obesity and diabetes, and this might be linked to a higher risk of stroke or a higher risk of dementia. But on the other hand, it's also possible that those people who are unhealthy to begin with, say those who already have diabetes, they already have obesity, gravitate more towards the diet sodas to begin with. So now this is something that we really need to explore in more detail to understand which way the association is going.
Hmm. Well, the American Beverage Association is responding to your study. They say in a statement that low-calorie sweeteners have been proven safe by worldwide government safety authorities as well as hundreds of scientific studies. And they also add that, quote, while we respect the mission of these organizations to help prevent conditions like stroke and dementia, the authors of this study acknowledge that their conclusions do not and cannot prove cause and effect. So, I mean, in that case, what is the utility? What's the real purpose of this study?
Sure. Well, actually, we don't have a lot of data on how diet beverages relate to a lot of different health outcomes. So, for example, it takes a long time to develop stroke and a long time to develop dementia. So it's not something that's really been investigated before. So now we really need these sorts of studies to investigate what are the associations between diet beverages and different health outcomes so that consumers can make informed choices about the beverages that they're having.
Hmm. But just to be clear also, Dr. Pauze, I don't see anything in the study that recommends people switch back to full sugar sodas.
That's an excellent point. We certainly don't recommend that people drink normal or regular sugary sodas. These are known to be associated with a range of different health issues such as weight gain and diabetes. So certainly drinking regular soda is not a healthy option.
Mm.
And I guess our study is calling for people to be somewhat cautious about diet beverages, questioning whether they're a healthy alternative. But as I'm saying, we now need more research to investigate this further before we can make solid recommendations.
Yeah, point taken. But let me also ask you one thing about the complexity of doing these kinds of studies, because the American Heart Association noted in a commentary that accompanied your study that the participants were overwhelmingly white, and it's possible that ethnic preferences may influence how people select sugary or artificially sweetened drinks. So comment on that.
I agree completely, and that's something we noted in our paper. One interesting thing about our study was that people were much more likely to drink diet beverages as compared to regular sodas. So it's possible that we might see different associations in different groups that, say, more frequently consumed regular soda, for example. So now we really are calling for other studies to see if our results hold up in other samples of different participants.
And finally, Dr. Pazzi, I'm just curious, the study focused on the possible elevated risk of stroke and dementia. Why those two diseases?
Sure. These are the two diseases I am most interested in, and thus it's the two diseases I wanted to study. It's important to note that we know that excess sugar is associated with vascular risk factors, and this includes things like obesity and diabetes and high blood pressure. And we know in turn that these conditions have adverse effects on the brain. So we felt it was important to understand the associations, therefore, between intake of regular soda, of diet soda, with different aspects of brain health.
Well, that's Dr. Matthew Pazzi, neurologist at Boston University School of Medicine and lead author on this study about diet soda drinks. Dr. Pazzi, thanks so much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And before we go, we'd like to say goodbye and thank you to Rebecca Entralgo. Rebecca's been our intern in Washington, D.C., and when she leaves us today, she won't be going too far. The Florida State graduate will be sticking around NPR to work with the business desk as it keeps tabs on presidential conflicts of interest. Congratulations, Rebecca, and good luck.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Megan Chakrabarty in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.